Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm El Amin Abdul Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
As more and more people are getting their second doses, Rosie, more than 20% of eligible Canadians now have a second shot. What are we going to be able to do once more people are protected? I want to dig into this two-dose reality because people are really eager to know what is and isn't allowed.
I want to know that too.
Yeah.
It's also probably time to talk election speculation.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's ratcheted up this week because the House of Commons is coming to a close. Could there be an election this fall? And what and who could trigger it?
So dramatic. Okay, let's do this.
Let's do it. As I drove to work this morning, we're recording this on Wednesday, as we do, I was listening to Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, on Radio-Canada interview this morning that he did to sort of wrap up the sitting. The House is expected to rise Wednesday, the day we're recording this, and parliamentarians, I guess they're not really here, most of them, but they're all going to go yes. back to their ridings and do their riding things. Anyway, so he was doing an interview sort of end of sitting, where are things at, you know, what's going to happen next. But the host was rightly hyper-focused on whether the Prime Minister wanted an election and whether there was going to be a fall election. And some of the language that the Prime Minister used were things like, you know, the Conservatives are getting in our way. The NDP, the Bloc, they are not, the progressive parties are not helping us get anything done. Canada needs to decide what kind of Build Back Better program we want when the pandemic is over. And by the time I got to work, which is not a long drive, by the time I got to work, put in my coffee order into my phone and closed the door, I was in a full state of panic, like a full anxiety, like attack, like, oh my God, I think he wants an election. That's how I came off of that interview. I really felt like he was saying things and positioning things in a way that I hadn't heard for, you know, like 2 years. And I'm not saying there's going to be one, but let me play the clip of the Prime Minister in English yesterday, which also fed into some of my anxiety. Now, it's also excitement because I love an election, but some of the anxiety. So here he is from yesterday.
We have seen a level of obstructionism and toxicity in the House that is of real concern. There's always a back and forth in Parliament. There's always got to be debate and holding people to account, and we welcome that and continue to. But there's also a time to work together. And that's certainly what we hope we're going to be seeing from the other progressive parties, the NDP and the Bloc, as we move forward on passing some really important pieces of legislation today and tomorrow that will make a difference in the lives of Canadians.
So we can talk about the legislation and whether all those things are true, but I'll just end my point on saying this, that when I sat down with the Prime Minister in very cold temperatures in December outside and asked him whether he wanted an election or whether he thought we were gearing up for an election, he pointed to the idea that if it became difficult to govern, if he felt like it was getting harder to push through his own agenda, then that would be a signal that there needed to be an election. Now, we can debate, and I'm sure we will, whether that's actually happening now. But it's certainly what he is now sort of laying the groundwork for, it sounds like.
Yeah, I love this language that starts to pop up about, like, Parliament is dysfunctional, Parliament is toxic, when it starts to creep up. Because I think, to me, like, it implies that Canadians are all, like, texting each other and being like, can you believe the delay tactics the opposition is using? What a dysfunctional Parliament. But like,
oh my God, they invoked closure. They've ended debate. Guys.
Right? Like, that's the implication. Like, the implication is like Canadians are up in a tizzy about this. But in reality, like, that's not at all the case. Like, it's just really the first smoke that we see when the election fire is about to start, right? Like, governments of all stripes say this, and it rarely means anything more than we're doing pretty well in the polls, we think it's time to go, and we have to concoct some kind of narrative that says this election is like, necessary.
Yes.
It's kind of like the end of the first act of any Fast and Furious movie. Like, Vin Diesel just has to find a reason to use a bunch of cars, because that's what you came for. You didn't come for another reason. But I...
that's it. Well, let's end the podcast now. That was so fun. Let's just end it now.
But I do want to talk about this, because I actually think even that does have some high stakes. Like, the stakes of not landing this narrative right is important.
Yes.
It is a fine balance. You know, I don't think any party can afford to look too eager to get into an election. People's minds right now are on the vaccine rollout. It's on the speed of reopening. You know, will my kids be able to attend in-school classes? A million and one other things. And then there's this, like, question of readiness. Like, the Liberals have been in power at this point for, what, 6 years? At this point, Aaron O'Toole's been leader of the Conservatives for 10 months. And even then, he's got, like, a whopping 2 months more on the job than Annamie Paul. Like, there was also a story earlier this week about how the House passed a ban on conversion therapy.
Yeah.
And out of 119 Conservative MPs, 62 Conservative MPs voted against that. And, like, for O'Toole, a leader who promised to modernize the Conservative Party, he's got to figure out how to reconcile a vote that looks like that with this promise. And, like, all of which is to say, it's easy to see that the opposition is a bit wobbly. It's easy to see that the Liberals have been in power for a long time. And they can begin to come across like they want an election. Like, mm-hmm. they really are eager to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in any other year, maybe that turns out well for you. I don't know how that eagerness will play out in a pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, we should point out that, like, the life cycle of a minority parliament is about 18 to 24 months. So we are coming to the natural end of that time.
Yeah.
Although, you know, you could say that it's been a little bit different and a little more challenging because of the pandemic. So maybe that's something to keep in mind. I don't know that the Prime Minister can make a very forceful case around legislation not being passed, given that they have passed lots of legislation. And the ones that they said were their priority bills will probably all get done because the Senate's going to continue sitting until probably next week. So that part of the argument, I think, becomes difficult or challenging. But could you make an argument that now that the pandemic is over, let's say, you know, towards the end of August, most Canadians have been double vaxxed, that we now need to start thinking about what a post-pandemic Canada looks like, and that time is ripe for debate? Sure, I think you could probably make that argument. I would also say that no one really remembers why an election was called. Like, that's usually the first week of an election campaign, reporters all talking frantically and doing stories about the outrage of the timing of an election. And by the time 4 or 5 weeks later people actually vote, that is not the first thing that's coming to mind. They obviously want to start digging into some of the ideas. And so to that end, Aaron O'Toole, you know, as you say, hasn't been leader super long. This would be his first campaign. And he's also lighting a fire, I would say, under this idea in case he ends up in an election. And this is what he told his caucus on Wednesday morning.
There isn't a choice between the Liberals, the NDP, the Green and the Bloc Québécois. They're all the same. And they're all part of the problem.
He also said there aren't five choices for Canadians. There's not five parties to choose from. Really, there are two. There are the Conservatives and there's everybody else because they all represent the same thing, which is a strong way to position yourself, as you mm-hmm. say, given that you're trying to move the party in a different direction and trying to win, obviously.
One of the things that we're dealing with also is the story of Quebec, like how this is going to play out, how a possible election would play out in Quebec.
Sure.
And our pal Eric Grenier wrote that the path to a Liberal majority would have to run through a pretty big winning in Quebec. And the situation there, I think, is interesting because, you know, Chantal Hubert pointed out in The Star that this is actually a pretty good stretch for the NDP, for example. You know, they're polling really well within their normal range of support. But the thing that's setting them apart right now is that Jagmeet Singh has the highest approval of any federal leader. That's supported, I think, by his responses to two big stories, the discovery of the remains outside that Kamloops residential school, and also his speeches about the attack on the Muslim family in London. Like, I think anyone watching the leaders respond to those events would reasonably identify Jagmeet as someone maybe responding with emotional proportion to the stories instead of like a political polish. And the flip side of that is that the NDP have supported the Liberals plenty of times over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And they will need a really good story for why they should be the alternative. And so I guess, like, at least from that perspective, it's really unclear what becomes of the NDP in the next election and what positions they sort of push forward.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And you could say the same about the Bloc, because the two of them hold the balance of power right now and have, yes, on different issues, supported the government so it wouldn't be defeated. And so the point O'Toole's making, you know, is a valid one. I think the Liberals also, as well as having to make the case about why an election might be needed at a time when, you know, people are tired and trying to get back to their lives, they also obviously are looking at the polls, and you mentioned the NDP there, but the polls are probably not as decisive as the Liberals would like them. Obviously, if you're going into an election, you're trying to better the outcome, in this case, trying to get a majority again. But, you know, on average, they're separated by, you know, 5 points, maybe. Most projections still have the Liberals short of a majority. If the NDP, as you point out, is successful in some places, that could do some damage to the Liberals. And if they can't pick up more seats, again, as you point out, in Quebec, then there's problems there, too. So it's not as though this is like sewn up.
Right.
And I guess that would be sort of my question for why it would be so important for an election right now. However, I will say that elections, campaigns do change things. We've seen that time and again. And the campaigns themselves matter, and people pay attention in a different way. And I know we've talked about this on this podcast before, but I feel like people feel more connected to government than they ever have, perhaps in their own lifetimes, because of this pandemic. You know, they may not be down with that much government in their lives, frankly, but they now have an idea of what government can and cannot do. And I wonder how that, too, will factor into, you know, what Canadians want to say about that idea during an election.
Queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Poord, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen. or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
I was just reading some exciting news, which is that the Toronto International Film Festival is back, baby!
It's your favorite thing. Your favorite thing, yeah.
Honestly, like, TIFF is like 40% of the reason I live in this city, despite the fact that I'm never going to own a home here. But that's like a conversation for another podcast. Yeah. 100%. The conversation for this podcast, though, is about reopenings and somewhat of a return to some semblance of normalcy and vaccinations and the planning for what we should say like is like the short to medium term future, because there are so many questions up in the air about that period of time. At this point, 75% of eligible Canadians have a first dose. More than 20% of eligible people are fully vaccinated. And I have to say, with fewer people than that having a first dose in the U.S., you and I talked about the CDC decision a few weeks ago to say, hey, if you're fully vaccinated, you can dance if you want to. You can leave your friends behind. You can do so many different things. You can let your mask go. And we thought maybe that's too soon, but we don't have the equivalence of a guidance kind of here in this country. We have no guidance for the fully vaccinated in this country. And now, you know, CBC ran a what you can do if you're fully vaccinated story. I think The Globe and a couple of other places did as well. And it's all of us in the media trying to fill a gap because we haven't heard much. Mm-hmm. We do know that the guidance is coming. We know this because journalists keep asking about it. Dr. Teresa Tam, our chief public health officer, got the question a few times. So did her deputy, Dr. Howard New. And here's what he had to say.
I think in the coming days and weeks, you will see the federal government coming out with different types of risk assessment tools, because I think to Dr. Tam's point, there's no single size fits all. You can't tell everybody, yes, you can all do this. It really depends on your individual context. So, you know, based on your own health status, what the vaccination status is of maybe the people you want to maybe socialize with, you know, all these other factors come into account.
So fair enough. No single size fits all. Mm-hmm. A double vaccinated person in Toronto may have to be more cautious or just have a different reality than a double vaccinated person in like St. John. But there is a restlessness to not having these short and medium term answers, I think, and it's starting to settle in.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, we are not, you know, that far along in terms of double vaccination rates, as you point out. Like, we've got a ways to go, but vaccines are coming in really fast and furious. So those numbers are going to go up very quickly, probably by the end of this month, sort of early July. We'll be in a completely different space. Mm-hmm. And I think people want to be able to plan and think about what their lives might be like. One of the things the government, you know, did do this week was start to talk about what travel might look like. And I say only start. Yeah. So if you have both vaccines and you travel to the US, for instance, you can come back and you don't have to do the quarantine hotel and you don't even have to quarantine. You're fine. You have to have a plan in case that doesn't work out, but generally you can just come back and you're okay. But there's still lots of questions around, you know, when is the border going to open more? Where can we travel to? Should we be traveling this much? Here's a case in point. I booked a plane ticket to home, where I haven't been since December 2019.
Oh, wow.
I booked a ticket home to Manitoba, not really knowing if that was going to be okay. Like, not really knowing if I was going to have to self-isolate when I got there for 2 weeks or how it was going to work. Just on the hopes that by the time the plane ticket comes around, that all that stuff will be clear and worked out and that someone will tell me whether I'll be able to hug my mom. But it is kind of... it's kind of curious that we are now, you know, close to the end of June and we are getting those numbers to where people want them to be. And still, we don't really know what the world looks like.
First of all, I hope you're able to hug your mom. That sounds like a really nice time for you. I want this for you.
Thank you. But I want the movie festival for you.
Thank you. Thank you. This is perfect.
Yeah.
All of our dreams should come true this summer. But like, this is a trouble with this idea of no one single size fits all.
That's right.
Because it's bearing out in all of the reopening plans. So Alberta's already in stage two. How do you do this, Alberta?
I know.
So Alberta has movie theaters, indoor dining, museums. They're open. They're open with reduced capacity, but they're open again. Alberta goes to stage three of its reopening on July 1st. BC, also in its second stage, then contrast with Ontario, which is only in step one. But that story that you mentioned about international travel restrictions changing. So yeah, the idea that if you're Canadian, fully vaccinated, you can just come back and not have to quarantine after. We're handling that through the government's ArriveCan app. And that starts July 5th.
Yeah.
So that's one way that people are able to prove that they're fully vaccinated while navigating borders. There's still the question of, will there be similar mechanisms for us to do things inside anywhere?
Yeah.
We don't know. And I think like this period of time where everybody's just wondering about the next step is rife with frustration. Like, it is nice. We should say it is nice that this is the next thing to worry about, because we've really made it really far in a short period of time. But it feels like maybe the place we've landed is a place filled with questions and no one willing to commit to answers, at least in the short term.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, provinces, of course, have a big role to play in this. That has been sort of the complicating communications factor throughout, right? Like, it is one thing for the federal government to give advice, for Public Health Agency of Canada to give advice. It's another thing for the provinces to decide, based on what's happening in their own region, how things are going to unfold. And I get that. You know, Quebec is also making changes, for instance, starting Friday. If you've been double vaxxed and you want to gather inside, you don't have to wear a mask.
Right.
Now, if someone said to me right now, you can do that, I still wouldn't do it. So I also think there's an interesting sort of you know, here are the parameters in which you need to operate public health wise. But I still think we're also going to see people making their own sort of risk assessments. The problem is right now, when you don't have clear parameters, I don't know. Does it result in the opposite thing happening, right? Then people just sort of do whatever they want. And I think that's the danger right now. Because of the Delta variant, which spreads very quickly. And I'm not saying there's going to be a fourth wave, touch wood, but there, if you don't put the things out there, the benchmarks out there, do you run the risk of having people just doing a little bit whatever they want based on their own comfort level? And how dangerous is that?
You do, particularly because over the last, particularly, I think, after the third wave, maybe we all got the sense that these guidelines are there for a good reason.
Yeah.
And people started to just be a bit more chill about the guidelines. I didn't see the same responsiveness during the first and second waves, but something kind of clicked with that third wave. There was real sort of fear in terms of following the guidelines. And now that there is an absence of guidelines, the worry becomes that people ease up too quickly because they're just looking for answers. Watching the U.S., like the Foo Fighters played a concert at mm-hmm. Madison Square Garden, I sure wished that I was there. But also at the same time, I was like, I don't know if that's for me. And I found myself like looking for official guidance. And I think mm-hmm. we're generally speaking like a pretty rule-following country. We like rules. Maybe we like rules a little bit too much. but that is also a conversation for another podcast. But having the absence of those rules, having the absence of that guidance, especially when you've come to trust it, can be really damaging in the short term.
You know what that is?
What is it? Tell me more.
That's the sound of me and my best friend on a patio. Having some Caesars, okay? Don't judge me. Some spicy Never. Caesars last weekend. That's what that was.
I'm so glad that you got to enjoy this. That's amazing.
It's like glorious, right? Just
life-changing. Yes.
The little things. it's not really that, though. It's also the sound of last call. Like, I didn't actually record that. last week, we asked you, we talked about the notwithstanding clause. So we asked you, do you think government should be allowed to override the courts? And when should they be allowed to do that?
And I should have trusted our listeners to have some strong feelings about the notwithstanding clause because they did. One person wrote in to say, politicians should never be able to overrule the courts. Politicians are in it for re-election, not the public good. The notwithstanding clause is just a paving stone for governments having unequivocal control. What's stopping them from using it over something like human rights? Mm. Another listener said, parliaments should have the power to overrule the courts because politicians are more accountable to the public than judges. And one more to share from a listener. The argument that governments should be able to override the courts might have some validity if governments truly represented the people, but they don't. Doug Ford was a choice of less than half of voters. # proportional representation.
Oh, interesting views mm-hmm. there. Next week is going to be our last episode before we take a little break for the summer in, you know, anticipation potentially of a busy fall. And we want to look at some big picture stuff because it's, as you would say, it's been a time. It's been a time. That's what I do. I adopt some of your mannerisms. I love it. So the pandemic's obviously affected our lives in many different ways over the past, you know, 16 months or so. So where have you seen or felt the biggest change in your life and where you live, in a good way, in a bad way? Tell us more about what this has been like for you. And we want to hear from you. So tweet us. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. And throw in the hashtag. Our hashtag is PartyLines. And let us know what you think.
And that's it for PartyLines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, chief political correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdelmahmoud, chief Vin Diesel officer and culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
Kind of shameful, that title.
I own it with pride. I don't have friends. I got family.
See you next week.
You bet.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.